All right, everyone, welcome to Didactic Mind, episode 43, One Man, One Book, Part 1. A very warm welcome to everyone listening in, a very warm welcome to my SoundCloud subscribers, a very warm welcome to all of my loyal readers from the blog, didaxreach.blogspot.com. Eventually, that's going to move, whenever I finally find the time to sit down and actually do the stupid migration to WordPress. That's what's going to happen. It will be moving to didacticmind.com, which is a proper self-hosted WordPress website, and hopefully you won't even notice the difference if I've done it right. But it's a matter of finding the time and actually sitting down and getting it done, because unfortunately Blogger is going to change their interface to something horrible, even worse than what it is now. And it was never that great to begin with, to the point where you can't embed video easily, and you can't do anything easily anymore, which is an enormous, immense annoyance. But at any rate, that is going to happen, and if you want to support my work, as always, please go on over to superbshaving.com. The link will be in the description box. You can order yourself up some very, very traditional masculine shaving products that will give you a great shave every single time, and you'll be helping through your very valuable contributions to support my own work and to give me the opportunity to keep doing this for another, I hope, 7.5 years, because that's about how long I've been doing this by now, longer than 7.5 years, in fact. I'm also very excited to announce that there will be a new course coming, which I have done, I've created in conjunction with an old friend of mine. I've known him for a couple of years now. I'm a longtime subscriber to his newsletter, Kyle Trouble. The precise details of that will drop in a couple of weeks. You'll be able to stop by and pick up the full course itself. And I believe it is easily the best value course that you can find on the subject that you can find anywhere, really. You will benefit from an enormous amount of condensed wisdom, experience, and knowledge that I have put together in the course of about 10 lessons and a bunch of downloadable content, which you'll be able to access. I know I'm being very vague, but I want you to understand that this course is potentially life-changing and will give you the tools and the strategies necessary to do things with your life in terms of exploring freedom and new horizons that you probably didn't think of before. It's really aimed at more of my younger readers, somewhere between the age ranges of, let's say, 20 to 40, thereabouts. People who have already established their own lives and are settled and doing their own thing in wherever they are probably won't benefit so much from it, but if you're in that age demographic and you're looking to do something different with your life, definitely head over and check out that course when it drops. And there will be links, there will be advertising for it. You will be making a very valuable contribution to my own success. You'll be making a very valuable contribution to Kyle's success. Kyle Trouble is the guy behind it. Good friend of mine, good guy, really cool dude. He's been doing this independent small business lifestyle in Eastern Europe for a long time. So you're going to benefit immensely from his wisdom, from mine, and from all of the accumulated hard knocks that we've gone through. So with that in mind, and with that bit of housekeeping out of the way, today I want to focus on a topic of some interest to me, and that is the Christian heresy that we know of as Islam. Now, I've spent quite a bit of blog space writing about this particular issue. There are several great old posts that you can, that you can go back and refer to regarding Islam's origins, its canonicity, its status as a heretical offshoot of Christianity, its historical impact, the nature of the Quran, and various other things. Now, this is going to be one part in most likely a two-part, maybe a three-part series of podcasts, where I'm going to look at some of the parallels between Christianity and Islam, and I'm going to analyze the man, Muhammad, and the book, the Quran, and compare them with what is out there for the equivalents for Christianity, Jesus Christ, and the Bible, specifically the New Testament. Now, let me make it very clear, none of this is intended to insult Muslims, although they will, by their very nature, find it insulting. I can't help that. That's the reality of Islam. Any challenge to it is regarded as a mortal affront. Any challenge to Islamic faith is regarded as a grievous error and a terrible sin. And Muslims are not known for reacting well to such challenges to their faith. Moreover, none of the things I am going to present are original research. I am not a theologian. I am not a philosopher, despite my pretensions, you might say, to be either of those things. I am neither of them. I don't pretend to be either of them. So what I am going to relay to you is all based on research and scholarship that far predates me, that has been done by far better men and women than me, and is best elucidated in books that I will leave links to in the description box, books which I think will be very edifying to those who go and read them. And in a series of videos by Dr. J. Smith, and I think he's a doctor now, he was definitely doing his PhD research back in 2018 when I ran across his, or no, earlier than that even, when I ran across his videos on the subjects of the Quran and the life of the Prophet, Abdul Al-Fadi, who was a Muslim and converted to Christianity, and has spent much of his time since then producing apologetics videos for a really excellent channel called Cira International, C-I-R-A, International, and Jay Smith's channel is Fander Films, that's P-F-A-N-D-E-R Films. I'll leave links to all this stuff in the description box, you can go look it up. The videos are really fascinating. There are two series on Cira International, one about the Quran and its many problems, and the other about the strange origins of Islam. Both are well worth watching in full. The first series is a 9-part video breakdown of the main claims of the Quran, and the second series is, I think it's 8 parts, thereabouts, concerning the early life of Muhammad the Prophet. Now, again, I want to make it very clear, none of this is designed to be insulting. All of it is designed to do with Islam exactly what has been done with Christianity for 2,000 years, which is to investigate and analyze the origins and the claims made by each faith. If you, in the Cira International series, in the Cira series, if you will, they open up the very first video. J. Smith and Al-Fadi open up the video by talking about how in Christianity there are apologetics and there are polemicists. Those who do apologetics are, as J. Smith points out, the equivalent of a defensive lineup in an American football team. And those who do polemicism are the equivalent of the offensive lineup. Now, the interesting thing about Christianity is that it has a very deep and very powerful and very strong defensive lineup, because Christianity has been attacked in every way imaginable for 2,000 years and has been under sustained assault that entire time. There is no more effective way to trigger someone, to render him incapable of rational or coherent thought, especially if he is sinful, than to invoke the name of our Lord and King Jesus Christ. The moment you do that, whoever stands opposed to him will immediately be rendered into a babbling, incoherent, foam-flecked, spittle-launching, raving, enraged lunatic, because he's just so angry at the mere mention of Christ Jesus, of Logos. Whereas, if you look at Christianity's offensive lineup, the polemicists, Christianity has a much weaker ability to attack because of the nature of the faith itself, where the Lord said very clearly, "It will be your lot to be scorned and reviled and hated. Know that if the world hates you, know that it hated me first." That's what he said. He was clear as day about it. And we are advised to rejoice in our own suffering and to rejoice in the hatred that others project upon us, because we pray for them and we seek out their salvation and we ask for their forgiveness and we forgive them in turn. And these are all very good things. But it also means that we are stalwart in defense, but very, very slow to attack. If you look at Islam, Islam is, in almost every single aspect, a mirror image of Christianity. That's the fascinating thing about these two faiths. Islam is almost unquestionably a heresy of Christianity, and that has been known for the better part of 1,400 years. That has been known from the days of the early church fathers in the 5th century, in the 7th century AD. It has been known for that long that Mohammedanism is essentially nothing much more than a breakaway branch of Christianity. And if you want to know why that is, if you want to know the academic understanding of where that comes from and how that happened, you can go look up an article of mine called Of Questionable Origins. It's one of the best articles I've ever written, in my opinion. And it breaks it all down, and it goes into detail through a book by Emmett Scott about the origins of Islam. And it's that book is well worth reading. It's brilliant. Extremely readable, extremely powerful, and really goes into the historicity of Islam itself. If you look at Christianity versus Islam, as I said, mirror images of each other. Islam claims to be a religion of peace, but is in fact a religion of war and suffering and pain and death. Christianity is a religion of peace. And in the unfortunate, common but unfortunate instances where Christianity has launched wars, or when war has been waged in Christianity's name, it has brought great suffering and death upon the world. There's no doubt about that. But whereas with Islam, there is no check upon the greed and rapaciousness and danger of rampaging Islamic hordes, in Christianity you will find time and time and time again, the violence and the brutality was stopped by Christians obeying Christian edicts and Christian guidance. Okay, the classic example is the papal bull of 1537, Sublimus Dei, in which the Pope of the Catholic Church told the conquistadors in absolutely no uncertain terms that the natives of the New World were ensouled, that they had human souls and therefore were approachable for conversion to the true faith, and that it was wrong, morally reprehensible, to treat them as subhumans, because that's exactly what the conquistadors did. And, as it happens, with pretty good reason, because if you know anything about Aztec culture, you'll know how violent, vicious, and brutal it was. and the same is true of Inca culture, and Toltec, and Olmec, and all the other various Mesoamerican civilizations. They were all kind of birds of the feather. The reports of the savagery of their treatment of prisoners and of their cannibalistic tendencies, are well known and well preserved. So, if you look at the books between Islam and Christianity, all of the claims that the Quran, that Islam makes about the Quran, are actually true about the Bible. But none of them hold up when you look at the Quran. All of the claims that Islam makes about Muhammad actually apply to Jesus Christ, but none of them apply to Muhammad. I'll get to Muhammad in another episode, I hope. I don't have the time today. It's going to take enough just to unpack all the issues with the Quran. But the basic thrust of it is that these two faiths are supposed to be related to each other. They're really not, other than the fact that Islam is a heresy. How did it become a heresy? Well, again, if you want the details, look into my blog post that I talked about, of questionable origins. And if you want to read the book on the subject, there is Emmett Scott's, of questionable origins. Here's the post. And the book itself is referenced in here someplace. Give me a minute. It's a little tricky to find. Where is it? Come on. It's in here someplace. Ah, here we go, finally. The Impact of Islam. I can't believe I forgot the title, but the content is phenomenal. By, again, Emmett Scott. He's not a PhD, he's not a doctor, he's not a professor, he's just a researcher, he's a historian. And he goes, he just basically did some homework. And he looked and did some research and found out that one plausible explanation for Islam's origins is that it actually started out as a Gnostic Christian heresy called an offshoot of Nestorian Christianity. It was a sect called the Ebionites. And the Ebionites were an interesting bunch. They were basically a branch of Reformed Judaism that accepted that Jesus Christ was a prophet, certainly, but was not the Son of God. He was merely a mortal man sent to the Jews to instruct them. They accepted that he was a mighty man, a great man, a wise man, a great philosopher and rabbi and teacher, but he was only a man. There was no spark of divinity within him. And this put them squarely within the realm of the Gnostic sects. The sects which basically said Jesus is merely a mortal. Now, the moment you start denying Jesus' divinity, you run into all sorts of problems with respect to the nature of the message revealed in the New Testament. And you run into enormous issues with the claims that he made, particularly in the Gospel of John, in which he made it very, very, very clear. I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one shall know the Father except through me. My Father and I are one. All of that stuff, which is revealed in the Gospel of John, becomes impossible the moment you reject Christ's divinity. And this has been a problem throughout the first, 600-700 years of Christianity's existence. In fact, it goes all the way through to about 1100 AD, if you look at the history of Christianity. This problem of Gnosticism has been prevalent for a very, very long time. But the Ebionites took it a step further and basically kept all of the canonical Judaic laws about diet and marriage and life restrictions and all of that. So the essence of the law was preserved. The essence of rabbinical and Torah law was preserved. But there were some additions made basically to accommodate Christ's message. And was this a particularly wise move? No. But it turns out that Ebionite philosophy and Ebionite thinking was thriving in Arabia right around the time of Muhammad, the supposed life of Muhammad. As you will see if you do some reading and investigation into the literature, the idea that Muhammad is or was who he is depicted to be in the Quran, the Hadith, the Sirah, and the Tafsir, is almost certainly not true. There is very, very little evidence to suggest that the man that is upheld as the Prophet of Islam was in fact a single real historical figure. And what the reality is, he was more like, most likely, a composite of three, maybe four biblical and actual historical figures. Okay? So, what does Islam say about the Quran, about the book? Well, there are four primary statements about the Quran which upon which Islam stands or falls. All right. The first is that the Quran is eternal. The headline statement about the Quran is that the Quran that we have today in Arabic is a book given, is basically a transliterated perfect copy of a perfect book which has always existed in heaven alongside Allah. That's always been there. It's always sat there with him the entire time throughout all of eternity. Now, is that verifiable? Is that justifiable? Well, that's a matter of faith. Okay, so maybe. The second claim that it makes is that this book was sent down through revelations to a man named Muhammad through the angel Jibril, as Islam refers to him, what we call the angel Gabriel. The third is that the Quran has existed unchanged through time from the date that it was written down in what the late 7th century or the mid 7th century thereabouts, and has never ever changed since then. The claim that Islamic scholars make, they used to make at least before the evidence caught up with them in a very, very big hurry, is that not even so much as one single dot or line has changed in the Quran in 1,400 years. That is an extraordinary claim to make, and if you can find even a single dot that has changed over time between manuscripts dating back to around the canonical foundation of Islam to the present day, then, in theory at least, that statement falls apart. And the fourth statement that they believe in is that the Quran is, as we have it today, is exactly the same as what Muhammad transliterated from, basically revealed to the world. Now, the moment you actually look at what the Quranic text says, you run into some serious problems. To understand why, you need to understand how the Quran is structured, how Islam is structured. Islam has one book, yes. Christianity has one book, yes. But whereas Christians look at the revelations in the context of the New Testament alone and look at it as the completion of the Old Testament, the Quran doesn't work the same way. The Quran is organized very differently. For those of you who aren't familiar with Islam, you might be tempted to think of the Quran as the Islamic equivalent of the Bible. It's not. The Quran is arranged not in chronological order of revelation or in chronological order of time, as it were, of Muhammad's life. It's not. The Quran is instead arranged from largest chapter to smallest. So the very last chapter, which is the very last chapters, I think, the last surahs and the last verses, the last ayahs, are apparently sourced, attributed to Muhammad's last and favorite wife, Aisha, who, by the way, for those who aren't familiar with Islamic history, Muhammad supposedly married Aisha when she was six and consummated the marriage when she was nine. So, you know, right there, I mean, you want a good reason to view Islam as a blasphemous heresy, that's it right there. Because Islam literally sanctifies pedophilia. And that's not an outrageous claim. That's not an untrue claim. That's exactly what it does. Okay? That's the truth. Now, what is the nature of the Quran? It is a series of revelations and passages which are actually quite dense and difficult to interpret because they lack context. It's not like the Bible, which is in many ways self-contained. It's not like if you read, just pick a random section out of the book. If you read the book of Job, let's say, and you read Job 3:14, you can understand Job 3:14 in the context of the wider book of Job because of what happened to Job in that book. You can understand Lamentations by understanding the life of King Solomon, which is given in the 2 Kings, I believe. You can understand Psalms, Proverbs. Proverbs and Ecclesiastes by looking at the life of Solomon. You can understand much of even the densest parts of the Old Testament, Leviticus and Deuteronomy, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy by looking at what preceded it, Genesis and Exodus. And even in the New Testament, if you look at the book of Acts, that is a history written by St. Luke, which is in chronological order. It makes sense. The Quran doesn't have this. It's not like Muhammad did this and he went here and this is what he said and he revealed that and then he went to another place and he did this and he did that. It's not like that. It's just a series, more or less, of revelations. And in order to understand it, you have to incorporate the hadith, which are a huge collection of sayings and quotations attributed to the Prophet. And you have to look at the Sirah, which is the biography of Muhammad, and you have to look at the Tafsir, which are the commentaries by Islamic scholars. So you have to do a huge amount of additional reading just to understand what's going on in the Quran, which is one of the reasons why it's so difficult to process what's going on there. Now, if you look at the claims made about the Quran, you immediately run into some very serious problems. The canonical story of Islam says that Muhammad didn't start receiving revelations. He was born in 570 AD, and he didn't start receiving revelations until 610 AD. He was 40 years old. He would go to a cave near, outside of the town of Mecca, where he was born, He was of the Hashemite tribe, which is one of the reasons why, for instance, King Abdullah II of Jordan is regarded as the rightful living descendant of the Prophet, because he's from the Hashemite tribe. So he would go into this cave to pray to his pagan gods. That's the story. Again, I'm not saying anything that isn't true. This is what Islam itself says. And he would go... One day he went in there and a terrible force gripped him and squeezed his body until he thought he was going to explode almost. He was going to choke to death. And the malevolent force, so it was said, I'm paraphrasing here, squeezed him and said, Akra, read. He held up this spirit. Held up a slate of some kind and said, read. And Muhammad said, Ma'akra, I cannot read. And he said it three times. The spirit gripped him and squeezed him three times and said, Akra. And Muhammad said, Ma'akra, three times. Why? Because Muhammad was illiterate. That's the truth. That is the canonical accepted explanation. He was so afraid and so terrified that he ran to his wife Khadija and told her about this terrible episode. And Khadija said, are you sure you were visited by a demon? And performed some tests on him, and it turns out it wasn't a demon. It was the angel Jibril, or as we call him, Gabriel. And Gabriel eventually, after the third time, said, all right, if you can't read, then listen. I will tell you what to say, and you will speak the truth. And he received a bunch of revelations, and then he went forth into the world, and tried to pass those revelations on to whoever would listen. Now, the problem with the idea that the Quran is the perfect copy of the perfect book starts with the fact that the first Quran was supposedly not compiled until after Muhammad died. The second of the rightly guided caliphs, the four descendants or relatives of Muhammad who took over the caliphate that he left over after he died, Abu Bakr, basically saw at the time that the various followers of Muhammad were reciting incorrect surahs and ayahs, and he decided, oh, I'm going to put a stop to this. I'm going to collect everything together and write it all down and compile a proper set of verses and chapters, and that is going to be the Quran. Now, he went to Muhammad's secretary, Zayd ibn Thabit, and he said to him, I may have the name wrong, but I'm pretty sure that's it, Zayd ibn Thabit, and he said to him, write down everything that the Prophet told you. And Zayd ibn Thabit has shown in the hadith collected by al-Bukhari a couple of centuries later, apparently said, what you're asking is impossible. This is, even the Prophet himself didn't want to do this. Why are you asking me to do this? And right there, we run into some serious problems. Number one, these hadith, which were collected about Islam, were collected in the 8th century. Muhammad died supposedly 632 AD. So already we're looking at the earliest scriptural evidence of his existence and his sayings 150 years later. Now compare that with the Old Testament. We have copies of the Old Testament dating back to the Dead Sea Scrolls from over 2,000 years ago, which are written in Hebrew, which agree almost to the letter with what we have in our Bibles today. We have original fragments from the era of the New Testament, which give us a very good indication that the first of the Gospels was written within 30 years after Jesus' death by St. Matthew. We have direct evidence in the form of the letters of Luke and Paul and the other epistles. We have very well-preserved fragments of those letters. We have very well-preserved copies of those fragments of those letters. We have very well-preserved parchments and manuscripts dating back to the 4th century, which compile all of the books together. We have a complete set of books in the Bible, as we understand it, dating back to about the 5th century. Now, within a generation of Jesus' death, we know, we have excellent archaeological information, first-hand reports, first-hand eyewitness accounts telling us that he existed. We have, moreover, evidence from people who didn't like him in the form of Josephus and Tacitus, Roman historians, Josephus being a Jew, Tacitus being a Roman. They did not like Jesus, but they regarded him as a messianic figure. They didn't like the fact that he was a messianic figure, but they regarded him as one. So the claim that Christians make about the Bible being sent down to man by God is substantially borne out by the evidence. And the more you look at the evidence, the more you realize that is the truth. Christians, unlike Muslims, do not claim that the Bible is the inerrant word of God. It isn't. We know and we agree and we accept that there have been additions and changes and subtractions made. We know that the Vatican Church removed books from the Bible. There are 11 books missing from our current Bibles that used to be in the Bibles like, 500 something years ago. That's a fact. You can go look it up. The reason those 11 books are missing is because they kind of were regarded more like as commentaries or wisdom books. They weren't really directly attached to the main thrust of the Gospels and the Testaments. We know that some of the older manuscripts do not contain certain passages. If you look at chapters in Matthew, passages in Matthew or Luke or John, you will see, if you open up an English Standard version of your Bible, you will see clearly written, this is, you know, some of the manuscripts do not contain this next set of passages, right? We're very open about that. We accept that the Bible has undergone changes. There have been mistranslations, there have been insertions, there have been problems with the written word. We accept it. That's a fact. Muslims do not accept this. They refuse to accept it. They will not accept it because to them it's a direct threat to the entire foundation of their faith. But the truth is there have been numerous insertions, changes, and even plagiarisms inserted into the Quran. There is very good reason to think that the Quran itself is derived from an earlier Christian lectionary text written in Syriac, not in Arabic. The question that naturally arises for anybody who looks at the Quran and tries to understand it is, why, if God is looking to deliver a divine message to mankind, does he choose an illiterate man like Muhammad and an obscure language like Arabic, when there are already existing powerful Semitic languages like Aramaic and Hebrew and Syriac, which are widely spoken throughout that region and which work well? Remember, this is the same God that destroyed the Tower of Babel and confused the tongues of men and gave the children of Israel primacy over the word of the Lord, gave his chosen people, the Israelites, the task of bringing the word and the light of the Lord to the world. So why would he choose an obscure language like Arabic? Because according to Islam, the only way you can truly accept and absorb the so-called divinity of the Quran is by reading it in Arabic. Okay, here's another problem with Arabic. Back in the day, back in the mid-7th century, when the first compilation of the Quran was supposedly put together by Abu Bakr, Arabic as a language was not the same as the language it is today. Most importantly, it lacked the diacritical markings, the alephs and the dots and the whatchamacallits. Arabic as a language is very, very, very hard to learn. It's harder than Russian. It's probably harder than Mandarin in some ways, because everything that you read in Arabic is interpreted through context. You have to read a word in the context of the sentence in order to understand what that word means, and the same characters in a different context mean something completely different. I mean, I don't speak Arabic. I don't know if that's true. I'm just going by what I'm told. But apparently that's what it's like. It's a very, very challenging language. Very difficult to speak, very difficult to understand. But the problem is that even back then, Arabicists from the time said, I can't read this. I can't read this manuscript. Zayd ibn Thabit basically said, I can't read these compilations. The Sira film series will talk about Rasm, which is, as I understand it, it's basically the vowelization and the speaking pattern used to bring the written word to life. But without the diacritical markings there to tell you how to pronounce each character, different rasms take on different meanings very quickly. So the idea that this word of God is somehow inerrant through time is immediately put to the lie the moment you look at the very first compilations. Again, this is judging by canonical Islamic history. Canonical Islamic history also says that Abu Bakr put together these compilations of the Quran, had them all written down and properly transcribed, and then sent out various copies of this holy book to all corners of the caliphate, which at that time was undergoing breakneck expansion. By the mid-7th century, for instance, the Islamic caliphate had already expanded well past Arabia, into much of Persia, into the Holy Land, into the Levant, into Egypt, and was well on its way to sweeping towards Turkey, sweeping across North Africa, and eventually, 100 years later, would make landfall in Spain, and would stay there for the next 750 years. So the Islamic Empire was growing rapidly at the time, and was waxing powerful, and Abu Bakr needed a way to legitimize his authority and legitimize his status as the heir to Muhammad's legacy. But he didn't last very long. He was, murdered very shortly afterwards. I could be wrong about that. Don't quote me on this. If I am wrong, I'm happy to admit it. But he didn't last very long in his position as caliph. And eventually he was succeeded by somebody else, who was then succeeded by Uthman. Now, Caliph Uthman was a very interesting character. And he basically decided that the copies that Abu Bakr had sent out were themselves mistaken. So he had a new set of compilations put together. And he said, no, this is the true Quran. And then he instructed all other Qurans everywhere else in the caliphate to be burned. Now, why would you burn a sacred text? The only reason you would burn a sacred text is if you don't like what it contains. The only reason you wouldn't like what it contains is if somehow those texts contained information that delegitimize you as the successor to the throne. So, are therefore the texts compiled from the Uthmanic recension, as it's called, the Uthmanic recension of the Quran, the same as the Quran that you can get today? No, they're not. The earliest Quranic manuscripts put completely to the lie the idea that the Quran has not changed in so much as a single dot or letter in all of the 1,400 years that it has been in existence. The earliest Quranic texts date back a very, very long way, and there are even problems with those texts themselves, which I'll get to in a moment. The texts from various manuscripts, there's one in Samarkand, it's called the Samarkand manuscript, which is actually in Tashkent, in Uzbekistan. There's another one it's called a Topkapi manuscript, and it's sitting in Istanbul. There was another manuscript found in Sana'a in Yemen, which the Yemeni authorities initially were very excited about this. They were like, whoa, this is phenomenal. We have the earliest known manuscript is a Quran, but we can't read it because it's in very archaic Arabic. It doesn't have all the dots and the diacritical markings. So they brought in a bunch of Western experts to analyze the text and read it. And the Western experts looked at the text and they were like, wait a second, there's something very weird going on here. And they were discussing among themselves. And apparently the Yemeni authorities overheard them, quickly moved to confiscate all of their material, take back all of the texts that they had given, and booted the Westerners out. Now, why would they do that? They did it, most likely, the most likely and simple explanation is that they did it because those same experts had found evidence, substantial evidence, that severely challenged the notion that the Quran is eternal, everlasting, unchanged. The number of differences between the original manuscript texts as found in the Birmingham Folio, the Sana'a manuscript, the Topkapi manuscript, the Samarkand manuscript, these four major manuscripts. Numbers in the thousands, tens of thousands in I think is the latest estimate. And these aren't complete Qurans. They don't have like the full set available to them. And that's before you get to another really huge problem, which is with carbon dating the folios themselves. There's an article sitting somewhere on my blog about the Birmingham manuscript, where carbon dating on the Birmingham parchment revealed that it was likely to have predated the prophet himself. Now, you can't, the thing with carbon dating is you can't carbon date ink. It's not very easy to carbon date ink itself. What you can do is carbon date the actual leather, because it's parchment, so it's made out of an animal skin, right? And with the Sana'a manuscript, it's actually a palimpsest. What that means is that it's a manuscript made out of deer skin. So with deer skin, the interesting thing is you can write on deer skin once it's properly treated and prepared, and then you can wipe it all off and you can write again. So you have multiple layers of text which eventually get embedded into the skin, and the result is known as a palimpsest. And what becomes very interesting is that there are multiple layers of Quranic text inscribed into the Sana'a palimpsest, and they contradict each other. They contradict each other very strongly, and they contradict the current compilation of the Quran. Well, what is the current Quran? Even there, Islam can't agree with itself. The current compilation of the Quran supposedly dates back to the 1924 Hafs text, compiled by, I think, the authorities at Al-Aqsa University in Cairo. Now, that text is supposedly the true canonical, 100% certified, guaranteed, really for real Quran. But even there, it's not. There is a Turkish Christian researcher named Hatun Taş. I believe she lives in London. She's a colleague of Dr. J. Smith's, and she spent a couple of years running around all over the Middle East looking in various markets and bazaars and out-of-the-way places, nooks and crannies, looking for different Qurans. She didn't just find one or two. She found, thus far, 31 unique, distinct Qurans. And it's not like these are just different printings or different editions. It's not comparable to something like the King James Version of the Bible versus the English Standard Version or the American Standard Version or the New Living Translation or whatever. Those are translations of the Bible from the original Hebrew, Greek, and Latin texts into other languages. And these translated texts are very clear in terms of what they intend to do. The King James Version is written in archaic, difficult English. There's a beauty to it, which is phenomenal. I mean, if you read the King James Version, it is a very lyrical, beautiful text because it's written in such high English. But it's hard to read. It's a challenge to understand what's going on because it's written in such an unusual form of English. The English Standard Version is a close to literal interpretation of the text, but it's updated for a modern, relatively modern English audience, and it gets rid of, somewhat controversially, it gets rid of some of the gendering language of the King James Version, where I think one of the standard examples was like the King James Version referred to a stone using a masculine pronoun, and the English Standard Version refers to the same stone using a gender-neutral pronoun. I don't bother with such hair splitting. I'm just like, you know, if you want a translation of the Bible, get any translation other than the Schofield version. Most of them are pretty good. Some of them are better than others. I personally recommend the English Standard Version. I think that's phenomenal. The King James Version is also excellent. If you are capable of slogging through it like that, the New International Version is not bad. It's not great, but it's not bad. It's a little informal for my taste. The American Standard Version, if that's your thing. The New Living Translation has some excellent transliterations of the Hebrew passages, particularly in the Old Testament, which you don't get in subsequent versions. The standard example that comes to mind is Genesis chapter 3, verse 16, which I've referenced a number of times before. Pretty much every other translation gets it wrong. The New Living Translation gets that particular verse exactly right. It translates the Hebrew exactly as it was intended to be translated. These other Qurans are not like that. It's not like you have a different translation. It's literally a different Quran altogether. There are massive theological differences caused by changes in just one or two words in a particular passage. It's not like you can go back to the original Arabic, folios or manuscripts and do a direct translation of that from ancient Arabic. It's not that easy. It's not that simple. And if you want exact, precise examples, go look up the videos. I've got the links all there in the description box. It's all there for you to look at. And you will see the Hafs text next to some of the more some of these different versions of the Quran out there. The Warsh Quran is a particularly problematic one. And Hatun Tash sat down and compiled all of the differences, and there were like 15,000 plus differences. I'm pretty sure I underestimated that number enormously. But there are tens of thousands of differences between various Qurans. So even if Islam wants to, it cannot claim that there is one book that has sat eternal and unchanging. It's not eternal. It's not been revealed to Muhammad directly, because there are passages from the Quran which are direct ripoffs of passages in the Old Testament and passages in the Wisdom books and passages in the Bar Sanhedrin. The standard line that Muslims love to trot out is the one about he who saves a life, it is as if he has saved the life of the whole world, and he who takes a life, it is as if he has taken the life of the whole world. That is a direct ripoff of a passage from the Bar Sanhedrin, which itself was a reference to Cain's murder of his brother Abel, and the way that Cain spilled Abel's blood. By the way, Muslims always very conveniently forget to leave out the very next passage in the Quran, which is something along the lines of, "And he who blasphemes against the Lord, crucify him and cut off his hands and feet on opposite sides." Okay? They always leave out that part. I wonder why they leave out that part. So, no matter where you look at the canonical origin story about the book of Islam, at no point can you seriously argue in a scholarly fashion that it is what it says it is. It is not eternal. It was not revealed to Muhammad directly through the angel Gabriel. Because if it was, then why are there so many, mistranslations, mistakes? Why is it that Muhammad was called by his Jewish and Christian neighbors at the time, in a very derogatory fashion, the ear, because he hears everything and he repeats it very badly? Why was he called that? That's standard accepted Islamic doctrine. That's what he was called. And that's part of the reason why Muhammad hated Jews and Christians so much in some of the later passages of the Quran. It is not a complete book. There are a number of massive contradictions throughout the book itself. It is not a book that makes sense within in and of itself. Emmett Scott refers in his book to a passage, a very perplexing and problematic passage within the Quran called the Night of Power. And it's very confusing to read in Arabic. It makes absolutely no sense. But then if you read it in Syriac, it suddenly makes perfect sense. And it turns out that it's basically in praise of the birth of Jesus Christ. Which is a very strong indication that large parts of the Quran were blatantly plagiarized from Old Testament and New Testament texts and from Gnostic manuscripts of the time. Furthermore, it also means that the claims that are made about the Quran being a perfect revelation simply don't hold water. The Quran consistently gets wrong basic biographical details about major figures in the Old Testament, even though it accepts the Old Testament as the Word of God. The most glaring and ridiculous of these is when Moses' sister Mary, Mariam, is also referred to, is conflated as being the mother of Jesus Christ. Makes absolutely no sense, but it's right there. Jesus's brothers are referred to as Moses and Aaron or something like that. I may have the exact details wrong again. Look, my blog post was written a number of years ago. But what becomes very clear is that there is confusion and confounding details throughout the Quran in a way that you don't find in the Bible. The Bible is remarkable in terms of its lucidity and its clarity, particularly once you start looking at it through Christian eyes. If you look at it through secular eyes, it's actually very boring and difficult to read. But the moment you look at it as a Christian with faith, the scales fall away, and you start to understand why things are arranged in certain ways, why God chose to do these things at that time, why Jesus said these things at that time, and how various passages in the Bible are relevant to your life at a given date. So all of this stuff that I'm talking about it's not stuff I'm making up. This is stuff that's backed up by decades of scholarly research, and you're more than welcome to go look it up. I'll provide the list of the books in the description box. Robert Spencer's Did Muhammad Exist is an excellent resource. There is Andrew G. Boston's The Legacy of Jihad. There is Emmett Scott's set of books, Muhammad and Charlemagne, The History of a Controversy, and The Impact of Islam. There's also another book which I read. I'm drawing a complete blank on the name. But there are a number of excellent resources out there which are themselves compilations of earlier material and earlier scholarly research, which are well worth looking at. They're fascinating and very readable books, and a lot of fun to read and to explore and understand. And what falls out of all of it is just how mischaracterized and mangled the canonical origins of Islam are. And I've barely begun to scratch the surface on this subject. You know, I'm basically about out of time. I don't want to run over time on this stuff. But that's really all I have to say on the subject for now. Hopefully I will get to the life and times of Muhammad himself in a later podcast. Again, if you are offended by this, I can't say I'm sorry for you, but do try to understand. I am not attacking you personally. I am not attacking your faith, not really. I am actually trying to call you home to the true faith, to Christianity, to the revelation of the Word as given by Jesus Christ. Jesus Christ of Nazareth, and by his Father, the Lord. That's all I'm trying to do. And all I'm trying to do is expose Islam to the same kinds of criticisms and the same kinds of investigations that Christianity has been exposed to for 2,000 years. The reason why Christianity is true is because the more you look at it, the more closely you examine it, the more you realize it absolutely is true. All right, so that's all for this episode of Didactic Mind. I hope it was illuminating. I hope it was informative. As always, stop by the blog, like, comment, and subscribe here on SoundCloud. Make sure you visit superbshaving.com. Click on a few things there and do some Amazon shopping through that. I will get a cut of the affiliate profits. And I hope you have a blessed day and a blessed evening, and I will see you on the next one. This has been Didactic Mind, episode 43, One Man and One Book, part 1, and this is Didact signing off.